contextual analysis for optimization at environmental sites. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's class. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Geostatistics for Remediation Optimization team. Today's training course is based on the ITRC online guidance document, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. We're going to introduce you to the document during today's training class, and we do hope that this guidance document becomes a resource that you can use in your work. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. We're scheduled for 2.25 hours today so that we have at least a quarter hour at the end for your questions. We are recording today's sessions. During today's class, the trainers control the slides. If you'd like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. We do look for your questions and feedback throughout today's training class. Anytime, you're welcome to send in a question or a comment in that Q&A box. And we'll ask some of those questions out loud during our question and answer breaks. We'll have one in the middle and another at the end of the presentation. If you're on the phone line, you do have the option to ask questions out loud, but we do ask that you hold those till the question and answer breaks. At the end of the class, we do look for everyone on the call to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for yourself. So if you are interested in a certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended today's class. Once you submit the feedback form, the system's going to generate the certificate. Right now, the only way to get that certificate is through the feedback form. So be sure to fill out the feedback form if you are interested in a certificate. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators and includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. Also, we encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC, review the ITRC uses policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. So more information is available on the ITRC website, and I do encourage you to visit the website. It's a great place to find resources, guidance documents. We have our classroom, our online schedule available. We also do plan to offer classroom training, and we'll know more about that schedule later this year. I'll now introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers are members of the ITRC Geostatistics for Remediation Optimization team. That team was led by Ningwu Chang of the California Department of Toxic Substance Control and Harold Templin of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Dave Becker is a geologist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Omaha, Nebraska. He has strong interest in optimization of remediation systems and long-term monitoring programs. Adam Jansen is an environmental engineer with Barr Engineering Company in Minneapolis, Minnesota. His primary area of expertise is in groundwater flow modeling, and he has used geostatistical methods to evaluate and optimize sampling networks. Chris Stubbs is a principal consultant with Ramboll Environ. His specific areas of expertise include groundwater modeling, statistical analysis, risk-based site assessment remediation, exposure analysis, and human health risk assessment. Mike Kwasinski is an environmental protection specialist with the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety, located in Denver. He oversees responses for release from above and underground storage tank systems, AST-UST inspections, and assists with reimbursements from the Colorado Petroleum Tank Fund. On slide 6, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Dave Becker from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Dave?
Thank you, Juliana, and good day to everybody on the call today. And we'll go to what I call a milepost slide, which indicates what the sequence of topics that will be covered during today's training and highlighting that section that we're just about to cover. So I have the pleasure and the honor to do the first couple sections, starting with this introduction. So I would guess that pretty much everybody listening in today has done some kind of geospatial analysis or used the product of geospatial analysis. Because if you've ever looked at or created a computer-generated contour map, you've done some type of geospatial analysis. And these kinds of geospatial methods are applied through different software and tools and commonly used to create contours of piezometric levels, of contaminant concentrations, or the elevations of different kinds of surfaces, whether it's the ground surface or a geologic contact. So they're very common, and these methods are quite useful, and the tools that implement them can be quite powerful. And I want to just point out that really, the focus of this training and our guidance document is not just on geospatial methods, but it's really on the application of these methods to help us do our jobs better, to optimize the work that we're doing. Because certainly for me, and I would imagine for all of you, that we're being asked to do more with less, either by our employer or by our clients. We have to find ways to be more efficient. And certainly within the federal government, many of the agencies and DOD, Department of Defense Services, have specific policies requiring the application of some type of optimization approaches or tools on the project so they get the best bang for the buck. And it's not just, in one particular phase of the project, but it's actually throughout the life cycle of a remediation project. And so certainly the ITRC has been aware of the need to address remedy optimization. Actually, there was another team that prepared a good overview document on remediation process optimization. That's available online from the ITRC website. There are other tools available related to optimization on the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable website, and as well as EPA's CLUIN website. Just as an example, some of the tools that can be found at some of these websites, there are some optimization tools for monitoring programs, largely sponsored by the Air Force, three of which are shown there on the slide. And I should point out that throughout the training here on the slides, any of the bullets that have that blue underline and the blue color to them like that with the underline, those are active links. So if you have the presentation, you should be able to click on those links and go directly to those resources, which is should be somewhat convenient for you. So let's talk just a minute why this should matter to the folks listening on the call today. Well, first of all, geospatial methods really do help us do our job better and to optimize what we do. And when I say optimize, I really mean any kind of effort, for a cleanup project, where whatever phase it happens to be in, that lets us, do actions, take actions that improve either the effectiveness of what we're doing or make it more cost efficient or cost effective at that particular time. So it's kind of a broad definition there, but that fits nicely with the context that we use optimization for our guidance and the training here today. So I just have an example here. The figure to the right on the slide there illustrates the application of geospatial methods to optimize a monitoring network. And so if you look at that figure, the upper left figure shows the map of a particular parameter concentration using all the data points, all the wells that were available that were sampled. The figure to the upper right there is the map of that same parameter, but with about 30 wells excluded from the process of making the map. And you can see by inspection that the maps look pretty much the same. And what that tells you is that since you can map the plume to some reasonable level of accuracy, acceptable level of accuracy, without those 30 wells, they may well have been redundant, and you don't necessarily need to sample them if the primary goal was to define the plume. And so this is an example of, again, how geospatial tools can be used to make decisions to optimize our work. Okay. So what we you know, hope the geospatial methods can do is to achieve some kind of cost savings for our clients. Certainly through improved planning for the work that we do, whether it's in characterization or remediation, you know, or to even demonstrate the attainment of goals at the completion of our remedy to do it most cost-effectively. Certainly, geospatial methods can really enhance our ability as technical people to evaluate and interpret the data that we collect. Certainly, if we apply some of these methods during the planning process, we should get better, more targeted data, so we have better data to work with from the beginning. But then when we have the data, we're in a good position to use these tools to identify trends and spatial patterns in the data that would help us interpret what's going on and what needs to be done. For example, we may also be able to make more accurate quantitative estimates of numbers that really matter in design, for example, or in risk assessment, whether it be an average exposure concentration or maybe volumes or mass of materials that require treatment. The bottom line is that these kind of tools get us towards better decision-making, makes us better decision-makers. The other way that geospatial methods can help is by facilitating the communication either with our peers or with stakeholders, the public. Picture truly is worth a thousand words, and many of the data visualization tools that probably have, you know, awed and inspired us on our projects, you know, really use some of these geospatial methods, you know, at their heart to prepare them. Just kind of want to elaborate a bit on some of the interpretation here, that the geospatial analysis, you know, when you look at where different concentrations are found spatially, can and present them in a way that facilitates the interpretation, you can really kind of get at conclusions faster. So here's an example of some data. If you look at the figure to the right there, this is some zinc data in soil, and the data are presented as scaled size circles depending on their concentration. And if you look closely, you can see that the larger circles are nearer a river that passes by the site, and that as you get farther from the river, the circles get smaller. And indeed, the graph at the bottom of the figure on the right illustrates the same concept, only in a graph form, where the y-axis is the concentration and the x-axis is the distance from the river itself. And looking at these presentations of the data, it tells you that maybe there's a relationship between the metals concentrations in the soil and the river, and indeed this river does periodically flood and probably provides metal-enriched sediment deposited on the floodplain adjacent to it at different times, depending on what's going on upstream. You'll hear more about this study later on in the training. Again, just want to emphasize that the geospatial methods are fundamental to the visualization tools that we use to communicate, certainly in making regular two-dimensional maps or the more sophisticated and impressive three-dimensional graphics. And particularly with the three-dimensional graphics, the ability to rotate and turn representation of a plume or some geologic body or formation or even the water table can allow us to see things in ways that wouldn't otherwise be easily observed. And certainly it's a way to explain to the public, as I said before. So the figure on the bottom of the slide is a three-dimensional representation of some materials that had to be excavated. And, you know, draping the location and thickness of the material that needs to be excavated over a representation of the surface really helps communicate where things would have to go and would really help, you know, just a general layperson to understand the scope of what's being done. Okay. So now's a good time to ask a poll question. And I would like to indicate what role you would potentially play in using or applying or conducting geospatial analysis. And I know that many of you are listening, perhaps in a group of people, but if you could pick a response that's most representative of the folks that are there with you, that would be good. The results of this kind of poll helps us as trainers understand the students that we're actually teaching to today. And as we look at the poll results coming in right now, pretty clearly, we have a good cross-section of folks out there that we have quite a few technical people that are either reviewing or conducting geospatial analyses, a good number of project managers, and even some stakeholders. So, anyway, it's a good representation of the folks interested in our industry here. So I appreciate, thank you all for participating in that poll question. We'll go on to the next slide here. Just kind of want to highlight really the innovative approach to presenting the guidance. If you want to access the guidance that our team has prepared, it's all on the web and it's highly interactive. And as part of the guidance, there's a number of different tools that are available to help you do what you need to do as a team member for some of these cleanup projects. So we have what you see there with the figure on the right is the welcome screen for the document, the online document. And there are active links there that will help you drill down very quickly to the right material that you would need for what you need to do. But there are some other tools, as I said, that are available through links there. There are some fact sheets that address different common needs and questions that you might have. So those can be helpful. There is some handy tables that compare some of the software that implement some of these methods, give you a sense for the complexity and cost. There's a project manager's toolbox, which is a good one-stop shop for the kind of things that a project manager would find useful, including some of the fact sheets that I just mentioned, and then also quick links to other useful tools. If you're a technical person, more involved, not so much in doing the analysis, but maybe reviewing the results of somebody else, a contractor or a regulated party's work, there's actually a review checklist to help you make sure that the analysis was done in accordance with good practice, basically. And then lastly, there's a number of flow charts to help you work through the application process, to help you determine the right amount of data, a number of those kind of graphical tools that will help you work through the application if you're somewhat new to it. And again, there's that link there at the lower left to the guidance document, the online guidance document. It's really a cool, useful tool, and the online nature of it makes it very easy to get to what you need. So last thing that I want to kind of mention here with the introduction section is what our objectives are, not only with the training today, but with the guidance document itself. We certainly want to reach out to the technical folks and the project managers and the stakeholders and give them the information necessary so that they can determine whether or not geospatial analysis is appropriate for what they're doing on the project at that time, to help them identify questions that would lead them to effectively optimize the work at these different phases, to help them correctly select the appropriate methods of whatever complexity that would meet their needs, and then lastly, to help the project team members to understand, explain, and apply the results once the analysis are done with these methods. And I should point out here, apology in advance, I guess you could say, is that there's a ton of material in this guidance document. There are many people who work very hard to put all this material in there, and we're trying to condense a lot of material down into a two-hour training session. And so, we're going to fly fairly high here, give you some of the important concepts, point you in the direction of some of the links for the details and that, but, we want to get you started, but there's tons more that you can mine from the guidance document itself that we really can't get to in this training because it's just so jam-packed with good stuff. So We're back to another milepost slide, and I'm going to cover this one as well, as I said. And I just kind of want to cover some big picture kinds of things that relate to some opportunities to apply what's in the guidance document and to apply some of this geospatial methods. You're going to hear more detail from some of my colleagues who will teach after me here. So just kind of wanted to highlight that one of the common threads with the document is the idea of a geospatial analysis workflow. It's how you would approach a problem and apply geospatial analysis. And you know, starting with the conceptual site model is always a good idea. No matter what you're trying to do for a project, you should really, you know, critically reevaluate your understanding of the site. You should also, you know, review what the project goals are, because you want to be goal oriented if you want to optimize these kind of tasks. Then you can jump into the geospatial analysis part, and the middle three bullets there. First, performing some exploratory data analysis, and you'll hear more about that, just kind of looking at the data set, getting a sense for the distribution of the data and those kind of statistical things. Then you would choose a geospatial method that would be appropriate for your need at that time, build a geospatial model, and then check that model for its ability to recreate what we see, and then apply the geospatial method with that model and generate the results of interest, not only providing the output, but also evaluating the certainty of that output and the variability that might be in that output depending on how that model was initially created. So you do a little sensitivity analysis there. And the flowcharts that I mentioned before can really help with those middle three bullets there, and the review checklist can help you evaluate the results that were generated. Again, just to highlight those tools there. And at the bottom of the slide, there's a link to the section and information on workflow for geospatial analysis. This slide shows a number of the flowcharts that help guide you through the process, and obviously this is not something that is easily readable, but just wanted to give you a sense that you have some really helpful specific guides to get you to do the right thing for the right purpose here. And working through these kind of flowcharts will help you make good decisions about the application of geospatial methods. So that's another thing that is in the document that is kind of a core tool and framework. Do want to talk a little bit about certain general aspects of the application of geospatial methods, including the data requirements, some of the regulatory concerns and barriers. There was the poll question at the start of the course today. And so there were some people that have run into some barriers before, apparently. We'll talk very briefly about some misapplications of some of these tools. You'll hear more later about that. And then we'll finish up my section here with a discussion of some optimization questions that guide the application of geospatial methods for optimization. So we'll start with the data requirements, and again, there's a good flow chart seen here on the left that helps you identify how much data you might need for different complexity of the geospatial methods, and more about that in just a second. But the kind of information that we're talking about here is, you know, we need to have horizontal vertical coordinates for our sample locations or data points. Any spatial data should have spatial coordinates associated with it. you're going to need cleanup goals, again, to kind of give that context. And then, of course, the primary thing are the parameters themselves that have the spatial coordinates, things like, the geologic materials, groundwater levels, the moisture content, organic carbon, whatever it is, contaminant concentrations. All those are the kind of things that are going to be the parameters that you work with. The amounts of data depend, as I said, on the method and the objective. In some cases, your objective may require the use of advanced method, in which case you may need more underlying data in order to have good confidence in the output. Otherwise, some simpler methods, you might be able to get at least an initial idea, or an adequate idea with less data. So the flowcharts will help you with that. The again, as we saw with the poll question at the start of class, a lot of people haven't really had many barriers to applying these kind of methods. Some people had. And as I mentioned, there's a number of federal agencies. There's also some state agencies that have accepted different approaches for optimization. And some different agencies have really embrace the use of some geospatial method, including some of the more advanced ones. But it does vary state to state and agency to agency, so you really need to identify that ahead of time. It may be that the barriers come into play when you're trying to optimize certain activities within a certain more strict regulatory framework, in which case, you know, having a good technical basis for what you're trying to apply and explaining it effectively can really help break that down. And certainly, what we want to facilitate with this guidance and training is a better understanding of geospatial methods, because generally the more people understand these methods, the more readily accepting they are of these kinds of things. So, you know, we're really trying to educate people and allow these methods to be used more often. So let's do another poll question. Well, actually, I guess, Juliana, maybe we've already done that, but yeah, I guess you're showing the results from before. So, you know, over three quarters of the folks have really not run into a problem using geospatial methods on their projects, which is really good. So, you know, what we'll try to do is lower that that fraction that has had some problems. Okay, so I just kind of want to highlight some, maybe, or give an example anyway, of some common misapplications. The document does identify some of those kind of problems. The, you know, some of the common misapplications involve using or methods with an inadequate amount of data so that really the output is not really trustworthy. In other cases, it's taking your data and extrapolating beyond the spatial or even time boundaries of the data set in a way that's not justified. Going outside of where you have data becomes really uncertain and risky. And then some geospatial models, you know, the sort of the representation of reality based on the data that you have, may not actually consider some of the subsurface heterogeneity that you would have due to geology and contaminant distribution, for example. And an example of that is the figure on the right there, where you have data points on either side of a fault, and these data are piezometric levels, water levels, and depending on how you treat that fault, you may have different contours that you would draw based on the data you have. The model may not consider the presence of the fault, so that might be a limitation for that particular method. Other problems can be dealing with sensor data, basically the less than numbers in a data set. That can affect some of the conclusions in a way that can be surprising. And then the data that we collect, the measurements that we make, have some uncertainty with them, as indicated, say, by duplicate analysis of chemical concentrations or the very small-scale variability of other geologic parameters, for example. So you're going to hear more about misapplications in some of the coming sections of the training here. One of the last things I kind of want to cover with this overview is I want to highlight these optimization questions. One part of the guidance actually identifies different questions that help you optimize the activity at that life cycle phase. And there's a whole bunch of questions, and I've just selected, you know, some representative questions for the five different life cycle phases, from release detection through characterization remediation on to closure. And it gives you an idea of the kind of questions that you might ask for, you know, getting at optimization. And then the guidance will help you pick the right geospatial method to help you answer that kind of question. So as just an example here, one of the questions for the site characterization phase was, what is the appropriate sample spacing considering spatial correlation among the data points? And so this would apply to trying to be very optimal in selecting your sampling locations so that you don't duplicate information, but you don't end up with significant data gaps. And, you know, part of that would be perhaps constructing a variogram, a geostatistical activity, a geostatistical work product, and you're going to hear more about that here in just a bit. But looking at the range of the data in the variogram can be used as, at least as an upper bound of a sample spacing, for example, in different directions. Anything spaced closer than that would contain some correlation and duplicate information, for example. And so there's software that would help you do these kind of things. So that's just one example. So where do we go to from here? We're going to talk more about the methods that help you answer these optimization questions. And we've categorized the methods broadly into three categories: simple, more complex, and advanced. And you'll hear more about those. And again, there are tools that will help you implement any of these kind of methods. And I'm going to finish with a poll question here asking you, based on what we've covered so far, do you think you work on sites that could benefit from geospatial analysis? As the data come in yet, we've got a pretty high proportion that say yes. So we've got enthusiastic listeners today. That's excellent. And a few people that are still wanting to learn more before making a statement here. So that's great. Well, I'm glad to see that everybody's on board here. So we'll go on. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Adam Jansen there in Minneapolis, and he's going to talk to you about fundamentals of geospatial methods.
All right. Thanks, Dave. So our goals for this next section here about fundamentals are to give you kind of a high-level overview and explanation of how geospatial methods work, so that whether you're a practitioner or a viewer, you understand kind of what's going on under the hood in the software to be sure that the methods are being applied correctly. Now, as Dave alluded to, there are a lot of details involved with this, and like we really can't get too deep into those in this presentation, but we refer you to the guidance document for a lot more information. So Tobler's first law of geography here on the screen sums up the basic premise of geospatial methods pretty well, and that's, you know, if we collect samples close together, we expect them to be more similar than samples that are collected farther apart. So this relationship between similarity and proximity is called spatial correlation, and if we have spatial correlation in our data set, we can quantify it using geospatial methods, and that'll help us understand what's going on in between our data points where we don't actually have measurements. And if we can understand what's going on in between our data points, you know, then we can start to ask optimization questions like, you know, if we need to add more data, you know, where should we put it for maximum value? Or conversely, you know, do we have too much data? I mean, could some of these points be eliminated and we could save some money by not having to sample them? But it all comes back to the spatial correlation. So what does spatial correlation look like? On the left here, we have an example of a situation where there is no spatial correlation in this data set. So whatever property we're symbolizing here with different colors and symbol sizes is completely randomly distributed in space. So we could use classical statistics on this, but we can't use geospatial methods. But contrast that case with the other two that we're showing here, where clearly there is a pattern to the colors and the symbol sizes. So in the middle, we have what's known as a trend, which is a large-scale systematic variation. And for example, these could be, you know, water levels measured at observation wells. And it's easy to imagine drawing a contour map, you know, from this figure. The contour is going to kind of follow the color separations. You know, we could see that we appear to have a groundwater flow kind of to the lower left corner of this image. Then on the right here, we have a different case, which is known as an autocorrelation, which is a bounded spatially correlated variation where we essentially have clumps of similar values. You know, these, for instance, could be concentrations of some contaminant in the subsurface at a former industrial site. So the black bars are on here to indicate the apparent scale of the spatial correlation, namely that points that are spaced together at distances smaller than these bars tend to be pretty similar, but then they're more different when they're spaced farther than that. Now, it's important to note that the trend and the autocorrelation here are not mutually exclusive cases, and that often our data sets are going to include some combination of both. And so to illustrate what that kind of looks like, you know, imagine here we're looking at a slice through a pretty high-resolution data set, which is the black line here. You can see there's a lot of variability in this data set, but overall there does appear to be this kind of larger-scale variation that we've traced here with the blue line. And so the blue line indicates the trend in this data set, and then the autocorrelation component is represented by the deviation from that trend in the black line. A geospatial model can contain up to three components here. We've already talked about the trend and the autocorrelation. Then the third one is an error model to account for error in the measurements. And as Dave mentioned in the previous section, you know, we've grouped methods together into three categories called simple, more complex, and advanced, based on like which components of the geospatial model that they can include. So any of these methods can be used to represent a trend, but if we want to include an error model, we're restricted to using the more complex and advanced methods. And what really sets the advanced methods apart is that they have an explicit model for that autocorrelation component. On this slide here, we have a list of lots of geospatial methods and then how they fall into our classification scheme. So you're probably familiar with the names of some of these. The simple methods are all simple interpolation methods that, you know, just allow you some ways to basically connect the dots between your samples in space. So these are things like inverse distance weighting and natural neighbor interpolation and so on. The more complex methods are various types of spatial regressions and also splines that produce more of kind of a best fit surface to your data. And then finally, the advanced methods are what you may have heard called the geostatistical methods. So this is kriging and all of its various types and conditional simulation, where the real focus on this is modeling that autocorrelation component. So because the different methods, you know, have different capabilities based on what components of the spatial model they can include, they're more appropriate for some applications than others. So the simple methods are generally used for mapping. The way we would evaluate what's a good map or not is basically, you know, whether it seems like it makes sense with what we know about the site and what we've developed as our conceptual site model. The simple methods will allow you to estimate values in between your data points, but they cannot provide you with any measures of uncertainty associated with those estimates. And like, we need that to be able to answer optimization questions. So for doing optimization problems, we're limited to using the more complex and advanced methods because they're based on statistical modeling and will give us those estimates of uncertainty. Now, if any of you are familiar with using the Surfer software, you know that it's very easy to load a point data set into Surfer and generate a contour map using kriging, which is an advanced method, and never have to go through any statistical modeling. And if all you're interested in is the contour map, you know, that can be fine. I've certainly done that myself on many occasions with satisfactory results. But know that kriging is also going to give you an error of estimation associated with every one of those values that it estimated. And that number is meaningless if you just use the default values for the autocorrelation model in Surfer instead of actually going through the statistical modeling yourself, because that's what that uncertainty number is based on. So in a situation like this, if you're using more complex or advanced methods using default parameters in the software, you're basically turning them into simple methods, and then they're more appropriate just for mapping only. So to sum up a little bit at this point, you know, if we have spatial correlation in our data set, you know, that allows us to use geospatial methods in the first place. But we need to be careful with this, because if we have spatial correlation, you know, simply adding more data points to our data set won't necessarily give us more information, because it also matters where they're located relative to one another. You know, and in particular, if points are too close together, we may be collecting redundant information at those places. So to avoid doing that, we need to understand what the scale of the spatial correlation is to help us identify, as Dave said, kind of an upper bound on what we might use for a sampling distance. And so we do that using something called the variogram. And so the variogram is essentially a plot of variability on the y-axis versus a distance between pairs of samples on the x-axis. If you're using kriging or other advanced methods, you have to have a variogram, because that is the autocorrelation model used by the advanced methods. But even if you're not using kriging, variograms are still useful to help you identify that scale of spatial correlation, and also to, you know, help you see whether you have spatial correlation in your data set at all. So here we have an example of what a classic variogram looks like. So the individual points that are on this are what are known as the experimental variogram. And like, these are generated through a lot of number crunching of pairs of data points in your data set. And for more information on exactly how that's done, I will refer you to the guidance document. So once you've generated those points, then you fit a theoretical variogram model to them. So that's this solid red line here that I'm tracing. Now, looking at the variogram, we see that, you know, we think back to that basic premise of geospatial methods that, you know, samples collected closer together are more similar. We see that that's illustrated by the variogram. So here, where samples are close together, point spacing is small, variability is also small. But as we start increasing the distance between our samples, the variability is also increasing, but only up to about a certain distance, where then the variability starts to level off. And so that distance at which the variogram levels off is called the range of the variogram, and that is that all-important scale of the spatial correlation that helps, you know, us define what a good sample spacing is. This value of variability that the variogram appears to level off to is called the sill of the variogram, and that's theoretically equal to the variance of your data set. And one other thing that it's an important feature of the variogram is the y-intercept, which is known as the nugget. And the nugget is where you would include an error model into the variogram, and I'll talk more about that in a couple of slides here. Now, one thing that we have to be careful about with the variogram, you know, because we're relating variability to distance, the directions in which we're calculating those distances matter. And in particular, that's important when we're considering two-dimensional versus three-dimensional problems. That, you know, if at particular locations we're collecting samples at multiple depths, you know, there's variability that's not only due to being at a different XY location from other samples, but also variability related to the depths. So what's often done in this situation is to develop separate variograms for both the XY plane and then the vertical directions. So let's go back to those illustrations of spatial correlation and show kind of what a variogram would look like for each of these cases. So if we don't have any spatial correlation in our data set, we get a horizontal line for our variogram. We basically end up calculating the variance of the data set over and over again when we do the variogram calculations. For the case of a trend, we get an unbounded variogram. Because, you know, as we're computing differences between pairs of data points, you know, especially if we're looking along kind of the axis of the trend here, the farther and farther we get apart here, the more and more different the points keep getting. So that's why this variogram just goes off to infinity and it never reaches a sill. And then finally, that variogram we saw on the previous slide is the example for the autocorrelation case, where we have kind of the clumps of similar values. You know, and these black bars that are on here are equivalent to the range of the variogram, you know, showing you that a distance is smaller than that, but the points are pretty similar. You know, and we have a lot of spatial correlation. So now is a great time to do a pop quiz. So here's that same variogram that we were showing you on the previous slide. Number is on both of the axes. And so I'm going to ask you, what are the range and the sill of this variogram? And so while we're taking a minute to answer this, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the y-intercept of the variogram, or the nugget, you know, and the implications for this. So this is where you would include an error model in your analysis. And for this particular variogram, the nugget is zero. So that means that if we went out to a site and we collected two samples at exactly the same location, we should expect them to have exactly the same value. So there's no error in the measurements. Now, we know, of course, that that's certainly not always the case, but the data will help guide you as to what an appropriate value is to use for the nugget in a case where you do need to include measurement error into the analysis. And so it could be just from, like, you know, whatever the best fit to this experimental variogram is. You know, here it looks like, you know, going through zero is a pretty good fit, but that may not always be the case. Or if, you know, you have other information, like, you know pretty well what the error in your instrument is that you're taking measurements with, or you have analysis of duplicate samples. You know, as other ways of being able to say, you know, what an appropriate value to use is for the nugget. And I'll talk a little bit more about the implications of this in a future slide. So I think at this point we'll go ahead and close the poll. Most people have had a chance to answer. And we will reveal the answer, which is, as most people seem to have seen, the correct answer here is C, that the range of this variogram is 24 and the sill is 9. So as we remember, the sill is theoretically the variance of our data set, and the range is that scale of spatial correlation, which helps us identify, you know, what an optimal sample spacing is for our particular site. And so with a case study here of how this is important. So this is a case study that's in the GRO1 document, and this is a live link to take you there if you're interested in reading more about it. This was a sediment site in New Jersey, where they had PCB contamination, and then they needed to do sampling to figure out what area of the sediment they would have to remediate that had concentrations above the standard. So over a seven-year period from 2001 to 2008, the authors of this study went out and collected 749 samples in the sediment to do that delineation. But after doing that, they thought about, wow, that's a lot of samples. You know, did we really need 749 to answer this question? And so they went back retrospectively and applied some geospatial methods to see, you know, could that have let us be a little smarter with our sampling approach? So in the first 2 years of sampling, they had collected 240 samples. And they generated a variogram using that data, and it had a range of 400 feet. And so if they had taken that 400-foot spacing distance into account when deciding where to put additional samples, they found that they really only needed 24 more points beyond that for a total of 264. To be able to get basically the same delineation they got with the full 749 that they actually collected. So this is a pretty dramatic example of just, you know, how significantly you can reduce sampling expenditures and also the time to complete the analysis just by using geospatial methods to help guide you in where to locate samples for maximum benefit. So on this slide, I'm going to show six different contour maps that were all generated from the same data set, but just using different geospatial methods, to highlight some of the different assumptions and ways that they work. And so I'm going to start with a couple of simple methods here. So triangulation with linear interpolation is about as simple as we can get. And then natural neighbor interpolation uses multiple rounds of Voronoi diagrams to give us a little bit smoother map. But one thing we notice about these right away is that, these methods can only interpolate between data points. And so the contours are limited to the extents of the data. Another simple method we'll look at here that's, gives us a very different looking map is inverse distance weighting, which is also known as inverse distance to a power. And this works by estimating values as a weighted sum of nearby data points. And the weights are calculated as an inverse power function of distance away from the data point. And so as you can see, the influence of each individual point can drop off pretty dramatically using that type of power function. And so we often get bullseyes in our final contour map when using inverse distance weighting. And there are some applications where this is okay. Generally, it's a bad idea in environmental situations, particularly for groundwater contour maps, where we don't want closed contours showing up in here that really have no physical meaning. And so I pretty much never use this method, mainly for that reason, and would caution you to be careful whenever using inverse distance to a power, that be sure to look very closely at your results to make sure that they're still consistent with your conceptual site model. Moving on to more complex methods, we have local polynomial regression, which gives us a much smoother surface than any of the figures we've seen thus far. That's because it's not bound to exactly honor all of the data points the way the simple methods are. So it can give us a much smoother kind of best fit surface. Another more complex method are radial basis functions, which do a much better job of locally matching the data. And then finally, advanced method, kriging. Like inverse distance weighting, it's also using weighted sums of nearby data points, but it's calculating the weights using the variogram. And so it does a better job of avoiding these non-physical bullseyes in the final results. So at this point, kind of the obvious question to ask is, well, they give different results, so what's the right method for me to use for my particular site? And so as Dave talked in the first section, there are a series of pretty comprehensive flowcharts in the guidance document that will help guide you to the choice of the most appropriate method for your particular problem based on factors such as how much data you have and what question you're specifically trying to answer. So in the next couple slides here, I'm going to talk about just some general things to keep in mind when applying geospatial methods, just kind of tips and tricks, so to speak. So I mentioned kriging and inverse distance weighting are estimating values using weighted sums of nearby data points. And in the software, there's a parameter called the search neighborhood that helps define what counts as a nearby data point. So we have that illustrated here. This circle defines the search neighborhood. And so all of the data points that fall within this circle are going to be used to estimate a value here at the center of the circle. Now, you may never really need to worry about the search neighborhood because either the software may have a default value for it or it might calculate a value that it thinks is appropriate based on the spacing of your samples. But if you ever were to generate a map that looks like the one on the lower left down here, where we have really sharp transitions between colors, if I made a contour map instead, we would have had really jagged contours. That's usually an indication that the search neighborhood radius is too small. And so this is easily remedied, and you can smooth the map out as I've done here just by increasing the size of the search neighborhood radius. So exact versus inexact interpolation. Exact interpolation is another way of saying that the method exactly honors your data. So everywhere that you actually have a data point, you would expect the interpolation method to return that exact value at that location. By definition, the simple methods have to be exact interpolators. The more complex methods really don't. And then kriging can go either way. So it depends on what value you use for the nugget in the variogram. And so the nugget, remember, is the y-intercept of the variogram. Where the nugget is zero, kriging behaves like an exact interpolator. And so that's what was done to generate this upper map here. So this was using kriging with zero nugget, exact interpolation. You notice that some of these contours take some rather abrupt turns and some rather sharp bends here just to make sure that we honor all of the data points as they were measured. But we know that there's error in our measurements, and sometimes it can be significant. So if we use a non-zero nugget in the variogram, that makes kriging an inexact interpolator and helps it account for the potential error in the measurements. And so that's what was done to generate this map on the bottom here. You notice that it's much smoother because kriging is no longer bound to exactly honor all the data points. However, it can be difficult to defend or justify this lower map when showing it to a client or a regulator when it's very easy for them to look very closely at this, as we're going to do here, and zoom in and see that we appear to have data points that are in the wrong locations relative to the contours. And I got a couple of 170s here that are between 170 and 165. I have this 149 over here between 150 and 155. And so depending on who your audience is, you may like focus in on that and be like, wow, your map is wrong, because clearly the points are in the wrong places. So in many cases, we're forced to use exact interpolation for this reason. But there are instances, I think, where clearly if you know that there's really significant error, you can make a pretty strong justification that the inexact interpolation is actually more appropriate. In my line of work, I do a lot of work with state well databases, and the Wisconsin well database in particular only gives you well locations to the nearest quarter section of the public land survey. So basically, you know the well is somewhere within that like 10-acre plot, but you don't know exactly where. So if I'm generating a groundwater contour map with water levels from this database, should I really be forcing the contours to take all kinds of crazy bends and turns to exactly honor all of the points when I know going into this they could be, the location could be wrong by hundreds of feet? And so this is an instance where your professional judgment is important and knowing your audience and, just knowing all what you know about your data set to decide, what is the most appropriate course of action to take. So we need to be careful when generating contour maps that everything that we're doing, we have all the data necessary to accurately represent our conceptual site model, and in particular boundary conditions that may affect the solution. And so like maybe these aren't data points that like we went out and collected, but we still need this information somehow. So the example we're showing here, we have a shallow alluvial aquifer adjacent to the Big River. And we found some contamination in this aquifer, so we installed a pump and treat system to capture it. And then once the system was operational, we went out, we measured some groundwater levels at a number of wells, all the black dots here, and then generated a contour map. Once we had our contour map, then we looked at the flow path going forward from downgradient from MW1, and sure enough, it goes right to the pumping well. So, hey, our system works. We're good, right? Well, not so fast. If we look a little closer at this, there are some issues with this particular interpretation. So, number one, the river is assumed to be, by our conceptual site model, hydraulically connected to the aquifer. So we should not have any contours that are going perpendicular to the river. That would indicate no flow between the river and the aquifer, which is not the case. So clearly the river elevations here were not taken into account as part of the data set used to generate the contours. Also, it seems like we have a lot of closed contours around some of these wells that are not indicated as being pumping wells. And so that's because inverse distance weighting was the interpolation method used here. And as I warned you on a previous slide, that has a tendency to produce these like non-physical closed contours in the contour map. So if we correct both of these things, we use kriging instead of inverse distance weighting, and we include stages of the river in our water level database, we come up with a completely different result. So now we have a contour map that doesn't have any contours that are perpendicular to the river, but now our flow path doesn't go to the pumping well anymore. So we come up with a completely different result. And so this example just illustrates to make sure that we have all necessary data that we need included in the analysis. So that wraps up this fundamental section. Just a few key points here we need to make sure to summarize. We have to have spatial correlation in our data set in the first place to even use geospatial methods. So if we don't, we have to stick with more classical statistics. The geospatial model can include up to three components, a trend, an autocorrelation, and an error model. And then different models can incorporate different parts of the, simple methods can only do trends. You're restricted to using some of the more advanced methods if you need to include the error or autocorrelation components. And whether you need that depends on kind of what question you're trying to answer for your site. The variogram is a really key concept, being able to allow us to quantify spatial correlation and identify what that scale of spatial correlation is so that we can use that to optimize our sampling approach and not space points too close together. And just a warning to be sure to be you choose a geospatial method that's consistent with your conceptual site model. So in the next section, Chris Stubbs from Rambo Environ is going to go through some detailed examples of how to apply geospatial methods. But before that, we're going to take a question and answer break.
Thanks, Adam. Anyone is welcome to send in a question using that Q&A in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, you have the additional option of unmuting your phone, #6, and jumping in with a question. We also have a answer during this question and answer break. Have you used or considered geospatial methods in performing optimization of your projects? So have you used geospatial methods yet? A question that's come in, are there geospatial analysis tools available to use for air quality monitoring and assessment, site evaluation and risk assessment specific to air quality?
Yeah, I don't know if there, this is Adam, I don't know if there's any software that's, you know, specific towards air quality necessarily, but, you know, some of the same principles still apply. I mean, the methods aren't really, you know, forced to work with soil water or any other media. You know, you could certainly use, you know, some of these same interpolation methods to monitor, to interpolate air quality data, you know, as long as you know precise locations of where, you know, different measurements were taken.
We have a comment from the audience. Smoothing the maps is not always consistent with the physical reality. My experience is that the interpolation method averages data, thus neglecting the physical heterogeneity of the real site.
Yeah, so all of these methods, you know, are the ones we talked about so far, definitely like kriging and inverse distance weighting and others, are all going to end up with some smoothing of the data just because, you know, when they're estimating in between your data points, they will always tend more towards the mean than any extreme values because they don't have information to know really the extreme values are there. But in this next section, Chris is going to be showing some examples of conditional simulation, which is a different method that will allow you to preserve a lot more of the variability present in the data and, like, you know, give you different realizations of, like, what else could be happening in between the data points. Versus what some of these more deterministic methods give you a much smoother surface.
Can you briefly describe how to build the variogram?
So there's a lot of sausage making that goes into this. You can do it manually. It's much easier to use software for this. But basically the way it works is that you identify unique data pairs in your data set, and then you calculate the difference between the values at those points, square it, and divide by 2, and then plot all of those values versus the spacing between your two data points. And so you do that, you get kind of a really messy-looking plot, but then if you bin and average them based on points that are similar distances apart, you know, that's how we got the points on the variogram that we showed on the previous slide. And so it's there's a lot of detail that goes into it, and I encourage you to read the guidance document to, you know, see in a little bit more detail exactly how it works.
Are there suggested text, links, or other sources that explain the differences of these interpolation methods in more detail?
Certainly there's more information about this in the guidance document. You know, and the document itself is not a textbook, but we definitely reference a lot of them. So if it's still find that inadequate, you know, we do reference a number of other useful sources that you could go to for even more information.
Can you do a 3D variogram?
Yes. And so three-dimensional variograms, you know, depends on the software. I mean, like Surfer, for instance, is limited to just doing two-dimensional problems. But, you know, other programs like EVS or SGEMS or ArcGIS, I believe, will allow you to do variograms and, like, kriging in three dimensions as well.
How do you include the boundary conditions, such as the river in the previous slide or a fault, into a geospatial interpolation?
The way that we added the river into that example was just to put in, you know, a lot of points along the trace of the river that then, you know, all had the river stage set to them. And so the, you know, as far as how many points you would definitely need to add, you know, I would bias it more towards, you know, making the points really dense, you know, just to be sure that, you know, you're not going to have any possibility of contours crossing the river because they're spaced too sparsely. But it's just basically adding, even though it's a long linear feature, you know, just kind of discretize it with a number of points, and then include those points in with, like, the groundwater levels and the data set you're going to use for the interpolation.
What if you
Adam,
were in part – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to follow up on the fault aspect of the question. Adam, don't you think that if you had something like a fault, if you felt that the fault was, say, a barrier to groundwater flow, that you might segregate the population of the data points, you know, to either side of the fault, and then you know, contour them separately, assuming that the fault would represent the break, extend the contours to the fault. Is that the way you would do it? I mean, that's kind of the way I would approach it.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing that up. I don't really work with faults all that often, but some software programs will have a feature called break lines that will allow you to add like a no-flow boundary, like a fault in there. And so, it'll do basically what you described, Dave, that it will consider only the points like on either side of the break line. So like it'll interpolate one side of the break line using the set of data that's over there, and then interpolate the other side using the data on the other side. And so then you can end up with discontinuous contours then along the trace of the fault.
Right.
And so then like you just need to know coordinates of the trace of the fault so that you could define the points that define the break line in the software.
So related to the example on the river before where it became a boundary, what if you're in part of the river that was not gaining or losing, or if the aquifer depth was not connected?
Yeah, I mean, if you know that the river is not hydraulically connected to the aquifer, you wouldn't need to include the levels in the data set. And certainly I think more for like a losing stream, maybe you wouldn't even need to have it in there, if you know that it's not really affecting the water levels in the aquifer.
Are variograms typically based on the full sample population? In the graphics shown, it seemed like they had significantly less data points, or is that just for visual clarity in the presentation? If not, how is the data that goes into the variogram chosen?
Yeah, definitely. I alluded to this in a previous answer to a question that, in order to get a variogram that actually looks like that nice clean set of points that we showed, there's a lot of binning and averaging that goes on. Like we're grouping together pairs of points that have, similar spacings, and then we're averaging the variability for that entire group. If you don't do that, you get something that's called the variogram cloud. It's just a very messy figure because there's a lot of scatter in this data set. And like in the next section, actually, Chris will be showing you an example of a variogram cloud, and what that would look like if we didn't do all the binning and averaging. But, to answer the question, we are using all of the data. It's just, by the time there's been a lot of processing that's been applied to it by the time we get to the final variogram. So it doesn't maybe look like we have as many points as we do.
Are there any links or websites or books that can show us geospatial analysis coding program?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
There was a, I'm not sure if the book by John Davis, Statistics and Data Analysis in Geology, they used to have some Fortran code for doing some of the geospatial methods in that book, but I'm not sure the more recent edition, the most recent edition of that book has that. I'd have to go back and look.
Thank you. If you think of something, we'll follow up. We do have that question in our Q&A. And we have several other questions we haven't got to, but we'll continue on with the second half of the training class. Either trainers will follow up online responding to questions, or in some cases we'll try to get back to those in our second question and answer break. But for now, we'll continue on with the second half of the presentation. I do want to remind you at this point, if you need to leave before we wrap up, we still want your feedback. So in the middle, related links, feedback's the last item. You select feedback, and then you look down a bit. You select browse to. That's going to open that feedback form in a new window. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation. So if you want a certificate for attending today's class, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. And then once you submit that, the system's going to create that certificate. Right now, that's the only way to do it. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, and submit again. Looking at our poll question, have you used or considered geospatial methods in performing optimization at your projects? So we have about 66% of our audience has used them already. So we hope to be giving you more information so that you can continue to use those, and for those who haven't used them yet are able to use those effectively. Continuing on to the next section, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Chris Stubbs from Ramble Environ. Chris?
Okay, great. Thanks very much. So in this next section, we'll be actually looking at some more detailed examples to illustrate how you'd actually use these methods. Here's a little outline of the next section, sort of divided into three parts. And the first part, we'll just talk in more in general about how you might model the data for optimization. And we'll focus on the more complex and advanced methods, because those tend to be the most useful for doing optimization. And we'll discuss the geospatial analysis workflow again, and a little bit about what we mean by quantifying uncertainty in our predictions. So in the second section, we'll go over an example of how we might use more complex methods. And as part of that example, we'll show how to do exploratory data analysis before illustrating the nonparametric regression as the more complex method. And then finally, we'll look at the advanced methods, and the method we'll feature is kriging. And as part of that, we'll look at the techniques of model evaluation that, you know, you could use model evaluation for any of the methods, but we'll just illustrate it with kriging. And then we'll briefly discuss two other advanced methods, conditional simulation and co-kriging. Okay, so as Adam kind of explained, we can, if we're using more complex or advanced methods, we're kind of modeling the data using a statistical model, and that gives us the kind of best predictions at unsampled locations, and it also allows us to evaluate the uncertainty in those predictions, which can be very important for optimization purposes. You know, for example, if we have redundant data, then we might see that in our uncertainty quantification, and we can make adjustments to our sampling plan. Or if we don't have enough data, then we can find places where we need more sampling. So all of these just allow us to better optimize the sampling scheme that we do. So also, as Adam I mentioned, is this sort of modeling of the data is using more complex or advanced methods. It kind of goes beyond mapping it. You know, we can use the simple methods for making nice maps of data, particularly if we have a lot of data and we don't have a lot of gaps to fill in between the data points. But to make the best use of it, you know, we'll do some modeling of the data using these more complex and advanced methods. And the best way to go about it is to follow the geospatial workflow. And I just want to point out that this workflow is really very useful for both practitioners and reviewers. So, you know, whether you're actually doing the analysis yourself or reviewing an analysis that someone else has done, the workflow is a great reference just to make sure that you've gone through all the steps that you need to make the best model of the data, or, you know, check that the practitioner has made the best model. And to remind you to include a good set of documentation of the steps that you've gone through, explaining the decisions you've made and you know, showing how those decisions give a good representation of the data. So here is the workflow again. I'll just briefly go through it again. It's these five steps, which I would just recommend you go through every time you're approaching a geospatial analysis. Obviously, we start with the looking at the conceptual site model and reviewing the project goals. And basically, this we want to really figure out what are the key site features that really must be represented in our model of the data. And kind of think about what the questions are that we need to answer, and that'll help us later on when we're trying to evaluate our models or pick the right method. Second step is to perform an exploratory data analysis, which is just looking at the data we have and trying to understand it in general before doing the geospatial analysis. But we'll look at the distribution of the data, whether there's outliers or trend, looking at the spatial correlation, which you may remember we used the varigram for. And this final thing I've written is auxiliary data. That's something we sometimes don't think about, which is trying to find, you know, other related data sets that would help inform or improve our model of our kind of primary data. So we'll see an example of how we do that in the more complex method section. Then we choose our method, and there's some nice flowcharts in the online guidance to help you with this. And after we've chosen the method, then we build the model, fit the model to the data, and check it. And sometimes we pick more than one method, and we kind of can start off with more than one method and kind of check through here. We're using techniques of cross-validation and checking against the conceptual site model to see which one works best. And that's the one we can use in the final step of generating the results and evaluating uncertainty, if we're using a method that allows us to do that. All right, so just a review here. I've talked about uncertainty a fair bit, and I just want to review what we mean by that. These more complex and advanced methods give us some measure of uncertainty. The simple methods generally don't. And that's because the more complex and advanced methods are based on a statistical model. And if you remember anything from statistics, you may recall that there's things called standard errors and variance, which can be used to evaluate the uncertainty of an estimate that you've constructed. Perhaps if you've calculated the mean of some data, then you can look at the standard error variance to get a sense of, what's the spread in the data, or the uncertainty of that mean. And another way of doing it is to construct confidence or prediction intervals. And we can apply those to the geospatial methods as well. Another way of measuring uncertainty is to calculate an exceedance probability, which is this is particularly useful if we have a particular threshold that we're interested in, like a cleanup level or something like that. And we can present the probability that a particular spot that we're interested in will exceed that threshold, or we can map the probabilities using a map. So here's just a simple illustration of these concepts. This is just in one dimension, sort of along a transect, for example. So the x-axis is the distance along a transect, and the y-axis is, for example, a concentration or some other value we're interested in. So here's our data. So our first step is we fit a model to the data. Allows us to interpolate in between the data points. That's the black line. And then we calculate a standard error around that. So that gives a sense of how certain we are of the model in those in different areas. And if we make an assumption about the distribution of the error around our predictions, then we can actually calculate a 95% confidence interval. So that could be as simple as just multiplying the standard error by approximately 2 to get this confidence interval. So this is I've just done it in the one dimensional here, just to show, to make it sort of easier to illustrate. But we'll see as we go on examples how this works in two dimensions as well. So let's get to our example here. Now you've seen this before in Dave's section. This was some surface soil samples taken near a river, and we've looked at metals, and in particular we're just plotting the zinc concentrations with the kind of larger circles representing samples with higher concentrations of zinc. And as we saw before, the concentrations that are closest to the river appear to be higher. The circles are a little bigger there, so that kind of suggests that maybe it's the flooding of the river that's causing these elevated zinc concentrations. So that's kind of our big aspect of our conceptual site model. So we want to make sure that whatever method we use incorporates that key feature of the conceptual site model. All right, so that's kind of the first part of the workflow. Then the other part of that first question is, to look at the optimization questions that we're interested in for this project. So this example, we want to figure out what's the 95% upper confidence level of the mean zinc concentration. So maybe we're interested in doing a risk assessment, and we want to look at an upper confidence level of the mean, so we can perhaps compare it to a risk-based level to see if any remediation needs to be done. And the other thing I wanted to think about in this example is, you know, how we could use secondary or proxy data to improve our predictions of the zinc concentration. So we'll start with some exploratory data analysis. So first thing we might do is just look at the distribution of zinc using a histogram here. And you see here in this first one, you know, the zinc concentrations are quite skewed in that there's many more lower concentrations than there are higher concentrations. That's common to see in concentrations. So many of the statistical methods, you know, tend to work better if we have more normally distributed or bell-shaped data. So we might consider log transforming the zinc concentrations. And you see if we do that in the second histogram, we kind of get a more symmetrical, you know, more approximately bell-shaped distribution. So that's what we'll use going forward. That tends to work better. Now we'll look at the autocorrelation, which we do, of course, with the variogram. And we see that there's less variability in the closest samples that are close together. So there's definitely some autocorrelation in this data set. Now, we're not going to fit a specific model to this autocorrelation because we're not going to be using a Krieging type of method. But it's just nice to see here that the range of this data is maybe around 800 meters. That's where the variogram seems to level off to the sill. All right. Now we noticed that the zinc concentrations that were closest to the river are higher, and we can do a little scatter plot here to show that more explicitly. We see a definite trend of higher zinc concentrations with smaller distances to the river. And so we're going to try and use this as an extra secondary variable in our more complex method here. So this is a good example of how you can just construct a new variable, new set of data that's kind of useful. So here the data is this kind of relationship between distance from the river and the concentration. So we'll see if we can incorporate that into our model. I'm going to look for some other secondary data sources. And here we can see a map of the soil type. So we kind of divided it into three soil types. You know, I've just named them 1, 2, and 3. And then we can see if I just look at the summary of concentrations in soil type 1, for example, using this box plot, you see that the tend to be higher concentrations in soil type 1 versus soil types 2 or soil types 3. So that's telling me that there is a correlation or a relationship between soil type and zinc concentration. So this is another piece of secondary data that I can use. And this is an example of a categorical variable, which is can only take a fixed number of values instead of being you know, continuous. All right. So since we have some good useful secondary data that we can use, you know, we're going to consider more of these more complex methods, which are kind of based on regression. So we don't have an explicit model of spatial correlation. You know, we're going to take advantage of the spatial correlation, but we're not going to model it explicitly. And these more complex methods are nice because they're very flexible. And so the example here I've shown is that it's easy to incorporate features such as faults, you know, which was mentioned in the question and answer period. You know, if that's a nice thing about these more complex methods is that you can incorporate faults and rivers and all these other kind of boundary condition type features in more easily than in the other methods, particularly the advanced methods tend to have a little harder time fitting in all that flexibility. So since it is a regression type method, we have to remember there are some assumptions that regressions are based on, and that is that the residuals, kind of after we've modeled our data, and then we kind of look at the what's left over between our model predictions and the data, and those are the residuals. Those need to be spatially uncorrelated and normally distributed. So, and of course, we do get prediction standard errors or variances out of our this method so that we can assess the uncertainty. Here's three approaches to a more three types of more complex methods: parametric regression, which is kind of one we're kind of all used to of using quadratics or linear regression to model the data. But more modern methods are also available that are more flexible, like splines and kernel smoothing, and those can be combined in a sort of non-parametric regression approach. Here's just an example of what this might look like. So if we have a parametric regression, we're sort of limited to these kind of simple functional forms, like here's showing a quadratic. So we kind of have to fit the data, have to fit to a sort of very regular quadratic surface, which, not that much data, many data sets actually really match very well. But if we look at some of the non-parametric methods, you can see you can get surfaces that are very flexible and can kind of fit whatever data set that we have. So non-parametric methods tend to be what we like to use because of their flexibility. All right, so then we're going to show what happens when we use non-parametric regression with this example, and we'll use obviously the zinc measurements, and also we'll fit in the distance to the river and the soil type, and also one that we didn't talk about, but flood frequency is also turns out to be a useful variable, and we'll use the non-parametric regression to interpolate between our measured data points. And in the online guidance, it goes into a little bit more detail about how this is done. And then once we've done that, we'll use some model evaluation techniques. You should use some model evaluation techniques to pick the best variables to use when using these methods. Anyway, so here's what we get if we use non-parametric regression to predict the log zinc concentrations. That's on this side here. And, we see the pattern that we want to see, which is a concentration a bit higher near the river than they are further away from the river. So that's good if it's the conceptual site model. And then on this side, we see the standard errors in the prediction, so we can kind of see where the errors are in our predictions are highest. And we kind of see the highest errors nearest or where we have the highest predicted concentrations. And otherwise, it kind of fits the similar pattern between the predictions and the prediction standard errors. And you might just notice, take a look at, compare this result to what we see when we do Krieging, how the prediction standard errors tend to look a little different in the pattern that we see. All right, now we just want to check that now that we've done the regression, that we sort of are fulfilling our assumptions, which is that the residuals that are left over after we fit the regression are not correlated with each other, no autocorrelation. So here's a plot of the variegram of the residuals, and we see it's nice and flat, which in a variegram tells us that there's no autocorrelation. So we've definitely met that assumption. Okay, now that we have our results and we've kind of checked that the model is consistent with our conceptual site model and that the assumptions of the method are satisfied, that we can use it to actually calculate these average zinc concentrations and look at perhaps some confidence limits. And that'll help us with our optimization. If we want to find some locations that require additional sampling, we can see that in the map of the standard errors. And there might be some places where we need to actually perform some remediation because the upper confidence limit's over some threshold. So that's just an example of how you would, the things you might do with the results to sort of do a kind of an optimization. All right, so now I want to kind of look at the same example, but think about it from a point of view of using an advanced method. So basically we have the same exact data set, same conceptual model, but this time we'll just ignore the fact that we have this secondary data. We'll just try and use the zinc data by itself and not the other data types we used in the nonparametric regression, such as the soil type and the distance to the river. Similar kind of optimization questions. So our goal is about the same. So just a brief reminder of what the advanced methods are all about. In this case, we are going to use an explicit model of spatial correlation. So we'll actually fit a model to the variogram. And that's what the advanced methods rely on to interpolate between the measured data points. Now, because we have to fit that spatial correlation model, it only really works if we have enough data to allow us to fit that with confidence. So we do tend to need more data to fit a variogram. And there's some guidelines in the online guides about how much data you need. And one of the assumptions of the advanced methods is that, after we've maybe removed any big trends in the data, that the data we're actually going to use for kriging or other advanced methods are stationary, and that, the statistical properties of the data are kind of uniform as we look throughout the area of interest. They really only have to be uniform within our sort of search neighborhood that Adam mentioned. So we should definitely think about that assumption, because if there's sort of maybe two different regions that have, for example, totally different characteristics, different soil types or something, then the statistical properties of those two regions might not really be uniform. So we might have to think about how to address that. So it wouldn't be a good idea to just assume that there's, the data are just totally stationary over two different regions. Okay, so the advanced methods also give us prediction standard errors or variances to assess uncertainty. And the example methods are, kriging and co-kriging, and there's many different varieties of kriging. And one variation is we can look at point kriging or block kriging. Point kriging is we're looking at individual points, and blocks we're trying to predict over larger areas. And then also conditional simulation, which we'll talk about briefly towards the end of this section. And conditional simulation is a nice method because it doesn't smooth the data out like all the other methods tend to. Okay, so here are variogram models that we might pick to fit to our data. And here's the kind of most common types: exponential, Gaussian, linear, Matern, and power and spherical. And you kind of want to pick a model that tends to fit the general shape of your empirical variogram. One, just some kind of gross features here to point out. There are the linear model and the power model are unbounded in the sense that they don't actually reach a sill. They just keep going up and up and up. And you might observe variograms that look like that if you haven't removed a trend from your data. So if there's a trend, then you might see these unbounded variograms. The other ones kind of tend towards a sill or a maximum value, and they kind of just have different approaches to it. The Gaussian model and also has a bit of a curve in the shape near the smallest lag distances. That's also something to pay attention to. So we're going to have a little quiz here just to practice picking an appropriate varigram function. So you see the empirical varigram from the zinc data. And I just want you to pick which varigram models you think would be appropriate to fit to that data. And you can pick more than one. And often the case that more than one varigram model would be perfectly appropriate. But there are some of the models that just really wouldn't fit, so you want to avoid picking those. You know, again, in addition to looking at the whether the varigram is unbounded or not, you also might look at the behavior near the origin. So at the smallest lag distances, you kind of might look to see what the shape is of the model. Versus the shape of the data, the empirical varigram. So looks like people are still picking some choices. I'll just give a few more moments here just to get everyone's best answers. All right, that looks good. I think I'll just go on here just to kind of look at what the answers are. So so the first thing, you know, I talked about the unbounded or boundedness of the varigram. So this one definitely has a bound in that we see the data sort of the varigram kind of levels off to a sill. So, you know, this linear one wouldn't be a good fit, probably, and the power, you know, also wouldn't be that great of a fit because they're both kind of unbounded, but the data we definitely see a bound on that. The Gaussian isn't such a great fit just because of the behavior near the origin. This kind of doesn't have that little curve at the origin, so I would say Gaussian wasn't great fit, and these other ones would all be fine, I think. And that's pretty much what we see in the poll results. Kind of the most popular ones were these, the exponential matron and the spherical. You know, many people did fit the Gaussian, which, you know, wouldn't be horrible, but probably not the best fit. And a few people picked the power and the linear, which you know, probably not the best best fits for this data set. All right, just keep going here. So now that we've, we'll just sort of start with the exponential model. So if we do the exponential model, just fit the data to it directly, we see, you know, pretty reasonable fit. And we always pay attention to the fit kind of within the first, you know, sort of within the range of the mean part of the range. So we don't worry about the part over here where we're kind of far beyond the mean range because it usually doesn't fit that far away. So we focus on the fit kind of in the first part here. So you see here, good fit. You know, a reminder is that when you're reviewing someone's write-up of a geospatial method, you really should ask to see a plot of the varigram so that you can assess for yourself visually, you know, was the right type of varigram model selected, and what was the quality of the fit, which is, you know, you can see nicely with this plot of the model varigram versus the exponential varigram. So that's a good thing to keep in mind. All right, so here I was, you know, as I mentioned before, when your data has a trend like these groundwater elevations, and you construct a varigram of it, and here's by the way the example of the varigram cloud where we have plotted every single pair of points. So every point on here represents a pair of the data points. So we have lots of points, and you kind of see, you know, it's useful to do a bit of averaging and then just look at the general trend through that cloud. So that's normally what we present because the cloud is a little too noisy and hard to make sense of. Anyway, so we see when we have a trend, like with groundwater elevations, The variogram is unbounded, keeps going up and up and up. But I'd recommend that you just remove that trend by fitting some kind of a simple trend model to it. And then let's look at the residuals, because then you can actually get more information from your variogram analysis. You can actually calculate what the range is of your data, which can be quite useful for optimizing sample spacing and things like that. So that's my recommendation. And many of the software packages just kind of automatically kind of do this for you if you click the right boxes. They'll remove a trend from the data, and you can continue with the analysis from there. All right, so as I mentioned, there's many different kinds of kriging, and they kind of have names that are not terribly illuminating, I guess, in my opinion. Simple kriging, ordinary kriging, universal kriging. You know, it's kind of hard to know just from the names what those mean, but they basically all are similar in that they use a variogram model to model the data, but they have differences in the trend model that's part of it. So this is most of the time kriging, we include a little trend model in with the kriging, and it's a very simple trend generally, where we're either assuming it's just constant, a constant sort of average level, or in some cases that it's a simple polynomial function of the coordinates. So, and that would be with universal kriging. And we can do more complex things, but I would say to start off with, we generally just can use ordinary kriging with just a constant unknown trend. That's a good basic approach that'll work most of the time, you know, unless there's a very strong trend in the data that has a physical basis that you haven't removed already. So in the previous slide, I suggested that you remove the trend before you go on to the kriging. So, but if you didn't do that, then you probably will have to do some universal kriging or one of these other methods to include that trend in the data. All right, so here's an example of using ordinary kriging and using the spherical variogram, which, if you recall, was one of the ones that has a reasonable fit to the data. And here's the same data, but interpolated using an exponential variogram. So the only difference between these two is the variogram model I picked. You can see they look pretty similar. I mean, there's definitely some little spots you can see some differences, but generally they look pretty much the same. And that's often what you'll see. As long as you picked a reasonable variogram model, the results don't look that different. But, you know, one thing we can do is use some more quantitative methods of model evaluation to really dig a little deeper and see, you know, which one of these, which visually look about the same, which one of them actually might be a little bit better. So we'll look at that in a second here. But the general topic of model evaluation starts with just kind of evaluating our predictions against the conceptual site model and, you know, making sure that we've satisfied any assumptions of the method. And then we can go in and use a technique called cross-validation to kind of quantitatively evaluate how good the model is. And the nice thing about cross-validation is you can use it with any method at all, even the simple methods. You can use cross-validation. You know, you definitely want to use a computer for it because it's quite, you know, computationally expensive, because you basically run the method multiple times, and every time you pick one of your data points and you remove it, and you use all the other data to predict the value at that data point you removed. And then you could just compare what your prediction was to the actual data point. You kind of loop through and you do every data point, you know, one by one usually, and you kind of get a sense of how well it's done on all the different data points, and kind of summarize those and see how good the method is. You can also kind of do the same thing with the prediction standard errors. So you can also evaluate standard errors using cross-validation. Anyway, so if we do some cross-validation, We'll compare three approaches. So I've added in here a new one, which is inverse distance weighting, just to have a simple method to compare things to. So inverse distance weighting is just a simple method, but we can do cross-validation on it. And we're going to compare it to ordinary kriging with the exponential varigram and ordinary kriging with the spherical varigram. Anyway, so here's a plot of the cross-validation results. So I guess along the x-axis here, we have the observed data value. So let's just look at this one point right here. So we've got an observed value of around a little more than 6.5. But when we take that data point out and we use the method to predict at that location, we only get 5.5. So, we're way under-predicting at that data point. And in general, you see that all the methods tend to under-predict at locations that are, the higher concentration or the higher values, and they tend to over-predict at places with the lower values. So that's kind of the general thing that happens, because it's kind of why it's sort of smoothing out the data. It's smoothing the peaks and the valleys out. All right, so we can, in addition to looking at these things graphically, we can also be a bit more quantitative and look at these cross-validation results by sort of summarizing them in a table. So here are some of the statistics we might look at, just sort of the mean error, just the average of all those cross-validation errors. And obviously we want that to be close to zero. So here's a summary of the mean errors for those three different methods that we showed. You got to see that the spherical varigram kind of definitely has the smallest mean error, and it's not too different than the ordinary kriging with the exponential varigram. But inverse distance weighting definitely has a bigger error, and it's negative because we've got a sort of a negative bias in that we're sort of under-predicting things on average. Another way of looking at those errors is to square them all, add them all, take the average of them and then take the square root. That would be called the root mean square error. Again, we'd like it to be as small as possible. And we don't have to worry about positive and negative here because these are all going to end up being positive. So it makes it a little easier to compare the magnitudes. So here we see, again, inverse distance weighting is not doing as well as the two kriging methods. Another thing we can look at least for the more complex or advanced methods, is the accuracy of the standard error. So we can also look at these, compare the mean error divided by the standard error that we get out of the method, and or this take the root mean square of those standardized errors. So usually that root mean square standardized error is the most useful. So we want it to be close to one because we want the actual errors that we saw from the cross-validation to be similar to the prediction error that we get from the method. So if they're both exactly the same, then we get one. So we see here exponential varigram model does a little bit better in that 0.93 is a little closer to 1 than the 0.90. Of course, we can't look at that, we can't even evaluate those for the inverse distance weighting methods because that simple method doesn't even give us values for the standard errors. Okay, so here's another little reminder for when you're reviewing things. You should basically always do cross-validation to evaluate your method, and it would be great to see a summary of the cross-validation presented in a report and a little description of how that was done and how it was used to pick the best method. So that's a good thing to remember when you're a reviewer. All right, so here you see the results of the kriging, and here I think we've just done the exponential varigram, and you kind of see that we kind of get a nice pattern of predictions that are, tend to be higher close to the river, as we expect. And you kind of see this typical pattern in the standard errors that you get with kriging, and that standard errors are small right near the data points, and then they kind of get bigger as you get away farther away. So you can kind of clearly see, where we had data and where we didn't in this map of the standard errors. And I guess one thing I kind of point out, it sort of jumps out for me, is right here where we're in an area where we expect the concentrations to be higher because it's close to the river, but we've got no data points, and so the standard error is a bit higher there. So we might target that area for additional sampling, for example. Okay, so we can combine the predictions and the standard error to calculate a 95% upper confidence limit. So that can be quite useful when we have a threshold, maybe a risk-based threshold that we want to compare to. We can just compare it right directly using this map and kind of identify areas where this confidence limit's over the threshold. All right. Another type of kriging, which I mentioned very briefly earlier, is block kriging. And here's I'm showing block kriging using little 100-meter cell. So over every 100-meter, we're predicting the average concentration in those little blocks. And we also get a prediction standard error. So blocks are kind of useful if you have you say you've got sort of these particular sized remediation units where maybe you're going to excavate. You can only sort of a minimum volume that you can excavate out because of the equipment you're using. So you might use a block that matches that that area that you can do. And so you should kind of figure out what's the average in that block and then decide whether that block should be remediated or not. So that can be useful. All right. So as we said, all these kriging and regression methods tend to really smooth the data out. But in reality, we kind of know what's going on at the data points shown here by these little dots. But in between, there's usually all kinds of variability that we can't generally see in our kriging or regression plots, but we know it's there. We know reality is very squiggly generally. So here we kind of see some alternative squiggly lines that might represent what's really going on between the data points. We don't know exactly, of course, because we don't have any data. But we have an idea. We can get an idea of what might be going on by looking at different possibilities. So conditional simulation is an approach that where we kind of do a bunch of different realizations of potential versions of reality, where we kind of fit the data and the variogram, and we kind of simulate a more realistic, not smoothed out reality. So here's kind of four examples of different predictions that are consistent with the data and that matches the data at the data points and then also the variogram models. And we can kind of do this thousands of times to kind of see what's the full range of possible realities we might have out there. So it kind of helps us understand the uncertainty in what we're doing. So one way you might use that is if you're trying to figure out what's the area of that zinc contaminated area that's above a certain threshold. So here I've picked threshold of 1,000 milligrams per kilogram. And I want to know, what's the area that's above that? Now, I can use each of those different simulation results, and I pick, figure out what's the area above 1,000 milligrams per kilogram in each one of them, and I summarize them in this histogram. So you kind of see the probability distribution of areas that might need to be addressed. And you can kind of see, probably the most likely area is something a little less than 300 square kilometers, but a pretty big range that we could see, all the way up to something above 500. So that can be very helpful for planning for remediation to kind of, get a sense of what actually might be out there. And if you want to make this a little narrow, then we could do some additional sampling. So just briefly, I'll just mention co-creaking, which is a way of using creaking with secondary data. And the way you typically use it is if you have some kind of direct sampling of something that you're interested in, or you kind of have a sort of sparse but more precise sampling, and then a very exhaustive sampling over the whole area of you're interested in, but with a little less precision. So, for example, something you might get from geophysics. And this is an example that goes into, you know, a bit more detail in the online guidance. But you kind of see co-creating as a way of combining these more precise, sparse data with the very widely available but less precise data into getting kind of a fusion of those two data sets. So co-creating is something to consider if you have that at your site. So finally, I just have a little list of some questions for reviewers should think about when they're reviewing a report. And we do have a whole review checklist in the online guidance. But you really want to make sure that the method that was picked is actually described and how they implemented it. But this is something I don't see that much in reports. Is why was this method selected over alternative methods? And, you know, this is where you'd like to see, maybe some cross-validation that would show how the method picked was superior to some other methods. And you'd also like to see a good explanation of how all these parameters were fit to the data and how the goodness of the fit was evaluated. And you'd really like to see some assessment of uncertainty in the predictions. And probably most important of all, we really do want to see the resulting predictions be consistent with those key features of the conceptual site model, you know, whether they be faults or rivers or whatever. You really want to make sure that whatever you get out of the method is consistent with those key features. So that's something you always want to do. All right, that is all we have for this section. And next, I'd like to introduce Mike Kuczynski, who is going to talk about putting the GRO into practice in this next section.
Thanks, Chris. My name is Mike Kuczynski. I work at Colorado Oil and Public Safety. We regulate storage tanks throughout the state, as well as releases from them, and that's how we interact with putting geospatial analysis to work. So now we've seen some of the fundamentals and the methods that can be used for conducting the geospatial analysis, and we've seen some examples of what the methods and the applications can produce. In this part of today's training, I'm going to go over the guidance itself and some of the most immediately useful parts of it. You can put these to use to make your projects more successful and conduct your work more efficiently. And perhaps most importantly, you can use this to help communicate the reasons why or how you did your data interpretation to your clients and to the regulators that you work with. This guidance works on several levels, and it provides a basic understanding of the methods and the results, and it also provides a detailed nuts and bolts how-to explanation. This guide is a companion to some other ITRC guidance, including ITRC's groundwater statistics and monitoring compliance guidance, the groundwater statistics for environmental managers internet-based training, and the remediation process optimization guidance. And just as a reminder, we heard very early, geospatial analysis happens all the time. Anytime we infer a groundwater flow direction or create isocontours, or we look at soil or groundwater data by location or over time, we're doing a type of geospatial analysis. Anytime we assign a value to a location that doesn't have empirical data and we're basing that on the surrounding empirical data that we do have, we're performing geospatial analysis. This guidance is modern. It's a little departure from the majority of ITRC's guidance. It's now web-based and very easy to use. It's been out for a little while now. If you've had a chance to look at it, you may already be familiar with this. If this is your first time using it, you can begin with the navigating the website button, and it walks you through some of the basics and also how to use the fact sheets. The fact sheets are where this starts off, and they're sequential as you might work through a project. One through four walk you through the process. Fact sheet one walks you through the basics, explains how you can use the geospatial analyses during the various life cycle stages, provides some guidance on addressing regulatory barriers, and offers some optimization examples. Fact sheet two walks you through whether your site conditions and your data set are applicable for geospatial analysis. It also points you to some potential misapplications, and also answering some specific questions relative to the various life cycle stages. Fact sheet three walks you through how the analyses are conducted, building the geospatial model, also checking that the model produces reasonable results. And this is very important. You could run these models on pretty much any data set, but it may or may not help you out. So, and it's also the source of a lot of the reluctance to accepting geospatial analysis. If your model results look crazy and they have little relation to the setting or what's known about the site, it's not going to support your conceptual site model, and it's really not going to help you out. And Fact Sheet 4 walks you through the software that's available to help. So in this guidance, these fact sheets are available on your desktop, or they are also available as PDFs if you want to print them out and keep them in your field kit, for example. So if you do encounter some reluctance to using geospatial analysis, you can point your client or your regulator to this guidance, or you can use the information in it to help explain your reasoning for your method selection, your interpretation, or how you made decisions regarding the work that you've done. So it's not just a tool to help you perform the analysis, but it's also a reference that you can use to encourage acceptance of using geospatial analysis as a way to support your conceptual site model. This has been touched on earlier, the Project Manager's Toolbox. This is a very useful part of the guidance. It links back to the fact sheets and some of the other parts of the guidance that are most useful for project managers. Any of the places in the guidance can be bookmarked, and this might be a good homepage if you're going to use this guidance frequently. Another item that's been mentioned is the review checklist. Again, this is available as a viewable web page and also as PDFs that you can keep with you in the field if you're out working remotely. This checklist can be used as a way to verify proper usage of the geospatial analysis within your project team. It's also another way that you can communicate with your regulator or your client on how you applied the geospatial analysis to your project. And it also, through the hyperlinks that you see here, it points the user to the parts of the guidance that are relevant to the question being asked. So if you have specific concerns about any of the questions and how they were answered, this checklist is a good way to point a reviewer to those parts of the guidance for more information. Also within the Project Manager's Toolbox is a section on choosing methods. And so this walks you through selecting the appropriate geospatial method, depending on what data are available to you, and depending on the questions that you're trying to answer. And finally, within the PM Toolbox, a section on common misapplications. Hopefully this will help you avoid some of the pitfalls associated with geospatial analysis, and it's broken out to some of the more common mistakes that can be made during conceptual site model development, when performing your exploratory data analysis, and when using models. This is also very important with regard to using models to communicate the assumptions that are inherent to your model, so how they're used, and explain whether they're valid to your situation, to your client or regulator, whenever you present those modeling results. That will help foster some confidence in your interpretation. Also within the guidance, data requirements and method selection. So this shows some of the items of your conceptual site model that have to be met before you attempt to use geospatial analysis. It shows which methods are available to you depending on your data set. This can also be used as a training tool for your staff. So if you're trying to get your crew ramped up on the use of geospatial analysis, this is a great way to explain how you arrive at using any of the different methods. Also, of course, why you use this guidance is to try to optimize your efforts. This section here, methods for optimization, this is another way to help you choose the correct geospatial methods depending on what you're trying to address. The example shown here walks you through some of the questions you might need to answer during site characterization. And the same thing is available for each of the other life cycle stages. Again, this is another portion of the guidance that can double as a training tool. And then software selection, of course, you don't want to do these analyses and perform the calculations by hand. It would take you forever. So this section of the guidance walks you through some of the software options that are available to you depending on your needs, also depending on your level of skill with using them and how much you're willing to invest in them. So software availability, that's something that's going to change over time, but this section is still a great place to start as a resource if you either don't know where to begin with your software selection, or if you're comfortable with what you're using and you want to upgrade to a more sophisticated application. It comes with some tables that sort out the capabilities of some of the more common applications. These tables walk you through the life cycle stages and the ability of each of the applications to answer specific questions within those life cycle categories. And then here are the different brands of software available to you, and then whether they can address that specific question. These are in the guidance, they're Excel tables, so go ahead and download those spreadsheets, and you can sort and filter them however you need. Also, if you already know what kind of output you're looking for with regard to what type of map you want to show, or if you want to be able to show a certain type of display of the data, you can use this table to work backwards to help you select the software that can help you produce that type of output. So we've got a section here on using the results to perform your optimization. This part of the guidance shows some ways that you can use your geospatial analysis and apply those analyses to your project, including items like hotspot detection, correct sample spacing, and of course, remediation and monitoring optimization. So here's an example from the guidance. This is kind of an example. Early in today's training, we had a question of what is the appropriate monitoring network and whether active remediation is warranted. So you could use this type of display to support removing wells from a monitoring plan, for example. Here in Colorado, we see figures like this frequently. They're often a snapshot in time of a monitoring event, and that's great. But what's even better is when you see them side by side, as shown here, compare them to a baseline so you can show your progress of your remediation, for example, or simply how conditions have changed over time. Also, whenever you show this type of display of your data and you're showing your modeling results, it's very important to note what the modeling assumptions are and how you established your boundary conditions, for example. So you'll see this in the guidance checklist. So explain your methods, the methods that you selected, and describe the assumptions that go along with it, and communicate that with your reader rather than just showing a picture. For the regulators in the audience, we need to be aware of those modeling assumptions. As we saw earlier, interpretations can look very different when different geospatial methods are applied to the same data set. Here's another example from the guidance of a case study. In this one, the 95% upper confidence limit of the mean for each sampling domain was calculated using Cregan block values for the pre-excavation on the left and the post-excavation conditions on the right. So this is kind of a good example of the why this matters part of today's training. And if you want to take a look at how this could be used or how this might work as a template for your own work, it's the lead contamination in soil case study example. So as we get ready to wrap things up, the main purpose of this guidance is to give you information on the tools that you can use to create your data interpretation and presentation items that you'll use to support your conceptual site model. It'll also help you optimize your work, minimize any wasted efforts, and make your cleanup efforts more efficient. This slide just shows some of the things to keep in mind from today's training. And then some final thoughts and reminders. Looking back at this set of different interpretations, these were all made from the same data set, so just emphasizing that the method you select will really have an influence on how your data looks. So be careful with the potential misuse of precision or accuracy of your data points. Remember the exact interpolating issue of how you might have a data point between contours that doesn't seem to make sense. But also just generally make sure that your presentation fits with your conceptual site model. And anytime you create contours, keep in mind the boundary conditions and certainly the presence of any points of exposure. And so whether you're an environmental professional or a regulator, we all need to be aware of how these methods are applied and the assumptions that come along with them. If the assumptions aren't applicable to your site, your modeling attempts may just lead to incorrect conclusions and mistakes in decision making. Also, this guidance can be used for other things besides just looking at contamination. It can be used to estimate average concentrations, calculate contaminant mass, can be used to help with your sample spacing. Although the guidance, I should point out, it does acknowledge the importance of the conceptual site model with regard to sample locations, especially at the beginning of an assessment. But it does provide good guidance on how to weigh existing data to determine the best locations to sample next. But you could also use this guidance, for example, if you were to combine it with a membrane interface probe or similar high-res characterization tools, you could map out areas by hydraulic conductivity. You could use it to find and display areas of contaminant storage and transport, and then you could show them in a map or a cross-section. You can also use these models to evaluate the source strength and the geometry that would be needed to generate a plume that you see today. So if you've got a stable contaminant plume, you can use these to try to figure out how much contaminant had to be released to make a plume of the size that you see. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Juliana, and thank you for your time. And this just walks you through the parts of the guidance that point you to those particular items that you can use to help with your project work.
Thanks, Mike. We do have about 5 minutes for questions, so you are welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod. If you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and please jump in with a question. We do have links to additional resources that's going to allow you to download the presentation, access the guidance document, and we've also pulled together some other resources available on that page. Please complete the feedback form. We really do use the feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes. It's also your opportunity to generate a participation certificate for yourself. Right now, the only way to do that is to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and then once you submit, the system will generate that certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit, and that certificate's going to be generated. A couple questions have come in. Chris, for Chris's section, what software programs did you use to generate your parametric and non-parametric plots for your examples?
I used the R statistical software. You could have used any of the commonly available GIS programs too, but I had used R for those.
What would the contours look like under different hydraulic conditions?
Well, I'm not sure what specifically that's referring to.
Was that related to the river example that had been done earlier?
It could be. Do you have a comment if that's the case?
Maybe Adam does.
Yeah, I mean, all we know for that particular example is that was one snapshot in time. So, I mean, potentially the contours would look different, if we had water levels from a different sampling event. But the information that we had for this one, we wouldn't expect to see those closed contours around some of the wells, and that it really appeared to be an artifact of the interpolation, not, something about hydraulic conditions.
In the river example, wouldn't regression of concentrations to sample elevation be more useful than soil type based on the CSM?
Wouldn't regression of you could consider using many different types of data. So I think we only talked about a limited number of secondary data sets for that example, but there's many different ways of doing it, and that would be a good example of one that you would could investigate further during the exploratory data analysis, and then maybe test whether you actually got a better result when you included that during the model evaluation stage of things.
Are there geospatial model packages that allow you to create a geospatial map of the background levels and a sample contamination levels, and then subtract background to see if sample contamination exceeds background on a geospatial map?
I don't know if there's any specific software packages that would do that. It sounds like what you're talking about is you sort of have a background level of concentrations, and then overlaid on that are some elevated concentrations. So I guess since you've kind of think about some of these methods that we talked about, how they're kind of divided into a trend and an autocorrelation phase. So you're essentially trying to figure out what the trend, underlying trend in the data is, which would represent the background concentrations, and then kind of mapping on tracking the area where it's impacted. So I think you could use a variety of the methods that have been discussed, but I don't think there's any specific package that would really walk you through that. So you'd have to kind of get pretty familiar with the methods in order to do something like that.
Thank you. I have opened a poll question, so as we wrap up today, you're welcome to fill up these last couple of poll questions. Are you ready to use geospatial analysis on your sites? And thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance document? And we'll leave this poll open for the next few minutes, but we do need to wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us. If we did not get to a question that you would like an answer to the question, please email us at training@itrcweb.org. You can also just respond to any of those reminder emails for your registration confirmations if you have those handy still. One came out earlier today. You can send in your question, and we'll post that for the trainers to follow up after today's training class. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide, and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the website, itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.